Good evening. I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Lectures and Literature at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In Kabbalah, BINA is the primordial womb from which creativity flows. In this series, we bring you the voices of people who are very much part of today's creative flow who've come to speak at the JCC. On tonight's BINA, our guest is Ethan Kanan. And now, join Judson True at the JCCSF as he introduces Ethan Kanan.
Welcome, Ethan. Welcome home.
Thank you, Judson. A pleasure to be here.
Yeah. It's a delight to be back in San Francisco. I know you get here quite
a bit.
It
is great. It breaks my heart.
Well, let's start with America, America, your latest novel, the called by many reviewers your most ambitious. Maybe we can talk a little bit about what that means.
Sure.
How did you decide to have a political backdrop to the novel?
Well, I started this novel in the year 2000, and I wrote about 400 or 500 pages of it, or maybe three or 400 pages of it. And it was just a character novel. It was just the story of a working-class kid who falls in love with a wealthy girl. Working-class boy falls in love with a wealthy girl. And I was about two-thirds of the way done with it, and when September 11th happened, and I stopped writing. I stopped writing for about 3 years, and when I came back to it, I was just, as everybody was at that point, more interested in the world, more interested in politics, more interested in history, more interested in, you know, some kind of important truth rather than the things I can remember. I mean, you all remember thinking that, the watching O.J. in the white Bronco, thinking that this is the biggest news story of my life. And I remember thinking that also. And then when I came back to it, I was much more I've always been a political hound. I mean, how many of you miss the election? What do you do with the extra 3 hours a day right now? Everybody became a political hound during this election. And I really became one then, a little early, and wanted to work history into it. Wanted to make something, you know, it's not important. I think fiction writing is never important, but it's a little less than completely unimportant.
And what about the particular historical era that you set it in, the political era? 1971, 72, you use a real presidential campaign and then insert your fictional presidential candidate and your plumber son in this case, who's involved in it. How did you create that time period as what you wanted to set the novel?
Well, part of the thing about fiction writing is that it's never intentional. No one never makes decisions about it. You know, you read about fiction writing, they always say the first decision a writer makes is, you know, what point of view and what. But I think it's never a decision. It's really something inside you that needs to be written. I was 12 in 1972, and my oldest political memory, if that is such a thing, was carrying a UNICEF can for George McGovern in 72 around our neighborhood, and actually sending the money into the campaign, which I, you know, nobody was forcing me to do. And so that, there's something about fiction that takes place in memory, and nostalgia is a big part of it. So that was there's a senator in this novel who does something similar to what happened to Chappaquiddick with Ted Kennedy, and that seemed to me a turning point in American politics in which the enemies of liberalism had suddenly had a poster child. They had a face for it. Not only would Kennedy give away your tax dollars to others, but he would rape your daughters, essentially, or rape and kill your daughters. It was a real visceral response, and that sort of marked the beginning of the decline of liberalism that it seems to have gotten a little boost in the last 2 months.
So who is the senator character in the book who was running for president, and how did you decide to make him more or less of the book, and then let's talk about a few of the other characters after that?
Well, interestingly, he was no part of the book. He was nothing. It was a small little character novel. And he started talking, and he became the whole novel. A great deal of it. And interestingly enough, I don't think of him as Ted Kennedy at all. I think of him as Lyndon Johnson, because Johnson is an interesting character to me. And when I read aloud from this book, if I do it tonight, you'll see. I don't know if I will, but I read it with a Southern accent because I keep thinking of Johnson, because Johnson was this incredible figure. And I was thinking about this. I live in Iowa now. Anybody know Iowa? It's a state.
I think the dream began there in January. Is that right?
Yes, the dream began there in
this
January.
This past January.
So we meet every candidate. This would be an exceptionally large room in Iowa to meet a candidate, and you wouldn't meet a candidate in a room this large. You'd meet a candidate in a room maybe a quarter this size. You meet everybody. It's an extraordinary privilege. That's why we're fighting so hard to keep it, one of the reasons. And I should just say that in front of a California audience that it's important to start a political race in a small state, because otherwise the one with the dominant fundraising wins.
Because they can only reach people through media
advertising. In a large media market, the dominant frontrunner wins. Obama was in the rear of the pack when he came to Iowa. I've lost track of the question, but
we could talk about Obama a little bit, because I think both this book.
Oh yeah, I remember what it was.
It was about Lyndon Johnson.
Then we'll go back to that. So Lyndon Johnson. So I was thinking about power. What is the nature of political power? That really interests me. What is that? I see Roger Boas here, who knows about political power. What is the nature of political power? Where does it begin? I was thinking about Johnson in particular, where it began. And correct me if I'm wrong here, Roger, but it seemed to begin with Johnson in a room. When you were alone with Johnson, he already had political power. And because it was organic, because it was intrinsic to himself, to his character, every time he met somebody, that he was included, and it multiplied, and it became this massive political power that he was able, when it came down to it, to give away. When he signed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, he knew he was losing the South. The so-called Southern strategy was forever. That was the end of the Democratic control of the South.
At least until this year.
Until this year. And it's just cracking a bit. But he was able to give it away because it was intrinsic to him. Whereas, could you imagine Nixon doing such a thing? Nixon would never have done such a thing because it was not intrinsic to his personality. He didn't have that organic sense. So his entire political career was about gaining power. It wasn't about gaining it and then dispensing it. So when I was thinking about it, I couldn't decide among Edwards, Clinton, and Obama the night before the Iowa caucuses. David Brooks, who's actually, I think, you know, the New York Times columnist, who I think is very smart emotionally. Anybody read the art column he wrote about the presidency is a bacterium on the wound of the body, I guess is what he called it. Did anybody read that column?
It grows.
Am I making this up? he wrote it about a year and a half ago. The presidency is a bacterium upon the wound of the personality. That's what he said. And it was a pro-Obama piece he wrote very early in the campaign. That made a lot of sense to me, that of all those candidates, he was the one who seemed most able to give away power when it was necessary. I felt that Hillary wasn't able to do that, that her career was about gaining power at that point, as with Edwards. And so in the last second, I went for Obama, and I'm very glad I did.
And you can see that in Obama's potential cabinet selections a little bit already, too, giving away some power.
Right, exactly. Right. If in fact, I mean, most of it's rumor, but if in fact he does that. So that became important to me, and I was thinking about that question. And this senator makes a speech in here called "The Bridges of Hope," which I wrote this long before I had heard of Obama.
Plumbing is also important in the book, which was prescient, right?
I never thought of that.
Sifter, the main character,
is a loving mother
and a hardworking plumber, right?
That's right.
His license, I'm sure, is in good condition.
Who hopes to make $250,000 next year.
Yeah, right.
He has a book contract I just read.
So. I'm sure he does.
They say that, I just heard today that his book is due December 1st.
What do you think of that kind of production pace?
Well, that's good, you know. That's good. That's what it takes to be a good plumber, I guess.
You've had politics in your books before. Who Loves the Palace Thief? Not just as a book, but that particular novella. And that story is about someone who grows up to be a politician, and you see the kind of politician that they're going to be when he's a young man.
Right.
And in this book, Senator Bongwiller, who's running for president, champion of the poor, but a deeply flawed personal individual, there's this dichotomy between a person's public stance and their private stance. Do you see that changing now? Do you feel that maybe with the election of Obama that there's some change in American politics, or do you think that it's more temporary?
Well, I should say that that's the other question that fascinated me, is what do you do about men like Lyndon Johnson or men and women like Johnson who were great political figures and who passed a lot of the great social legislation, you know, between him and FDR. That's about all the good social legislation that's been passed, I would say. And in Johnson's case, were sons of bitches themselves, right? Isn't that fair to say that Johnson was a real son of a bitch and ruthless? And FDR was like Kennedy, or like any of the Kennedys, like all three of the political Kennedys, or like Teddy Roosevelt, was a great man of the people, but of the aristocracy. unquestionably of the aristocracy. And those are two questions that also interested me in this novel. Is that changing with Obama? I don't know. Poor guy, you know. What a mess he's inheriting at this point.
Yeah, who knows what the Dow will be when he's inaugurated, right?
Yeah.
By the time.
The array of problems is quite amazing. So, you know, is he going to be any different? Is he going to, you know, he's certainly, I don't know him any better than anybody else does. He certainly seems somehow to be through and through with his own character and not to be false in any way, but how do I know that?
There's a short passage here that I think is actually relevant. If you just start where the arrow and go to the word ruthlessness, see what you think.
Okay, there we go. To this day, I'm a student of politics, and it never fails to surprise me that journalists and politicians and all the people whom my profession now calls opinion makers can still be swayed with just a few of the right gifts and the right trips, with just a few of the right drinks and the right singers and the right last names, and that the citizenry in turn by the millions and millions can still be brought in line behind them. And it's only grown worse. Henry Bonwiller has disappeared now from the public eye, and I know, for example, that not many young people the age of my daughters even know who he is anymore, or that he was instrumental in getting our troops home from Southeast Asia, or that he funded the environmental protections that cleaned up Lake Erie and Lake Michigan, and the health laws that still allow a pregnant woman in our state, even if she doesn't have any money, to get some of the best medical care in the world for herself and her child. I suppose nobody rises to a position of power without cunning, but it still surprises me to see, as I have now time and again over the years, the mixture in a single person of such public idealism and such personal ruthlessness. Yeah, that was Johnson I was thinking of, you know, when I wrote that. And, you know, Obama turned down public funding after claiming he would stick to those rules. And I have to say, I thought that was great.
That's where the cunning comes in. Huh?
Yeah, you know, you need, practicality above all. What can you do? He needed to do that, and he did it. And it actually gave me confidence that he would not be beholden to unimportant ideas in the quest of important ones.
And Johnson shows up in your last novel, doesn't he? And Carry Me Across the Waters.
Yeah, you're right.
Where the main character meets Johnson. It's set up at the beginning. And what do you remember that scene? And can you describe what does he do? What does he
I
do
don't
with
remember the scene because I wrote that book so many years ago. But I know that this book opens with blah 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 blah. He called Lyndon Johnson a coward after paying $5,000 to meet him. And Johnson and Nixon have appeared in just about everything I've ever written. I used to be a doctor. I used to work at San Francisco General. And I used to be at times I've worked in the psychiatric emergency room there, and there's something about Nixon that has it just speaks to the crazy imagination. You don't see paranoid schizophrenics talking about Jimmy Carter. Wouldn't you say that's true? Mark Leary, who's one of the heads of psychiatry there, would agree with that. When I was a resident, it was Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon who were in the minds of all the schizophrenic. And I think that it might be because it's Margaret Thatcher was the mother, Ronald Reagan was the father, and Nixon was the sort of
the crazy uncle.
Yeah, the crazy uncle, right.
Yeah.
So there is something that about...
The threatening uncle.
The threatening uncle. And Nixon is a character in here. You know, for the first... My dad is here somewhere, but for the first 10 years of my writing life, no matter what I wrote, a father would appear. No matter what, I could write about fishing in the Arctic, and it would end up being a father story. But now it's sort of a Nixon story. there's something about him. And there's a story I wrote not that long ago about a guy who goes to a Nixon rally. And it's just something about these figures. I mean, Nixon is he's a desperate figure. Despite the fact that he was president, you know, there's still a desperation about him that you have to love, or I have to love.
And what else is left of his legacy in politics? Did you see any of Nixon in, say, the Republican campaign with Bill Ayers or anything like that?
Well, you know, I don't know if Nixon was the beginning of these dirty tricks or Nixon was the one who allowed them to be seen for the first time. You know, the Ayers thing was so pathetic.
Right, it's sort of red baiting after the end of the Cold War. It didn't seem to ever resonate with anyone.
Yeah, I mean, the clear intent, of course, was terrorist Muslim. If you say it enough times, there'll be some sort of psychological synthesis in your reptilian brain. And it didn't really matter that Ayers was a domestic, you know, the whole thing. The fact that they said that on September 11th, you know, that's all right. He said he wished he had done more terrorism. His book happened to be published on September 10th, so the interview was, you know all this story, right?
Yeah.
The interview was published on September 11th. It's just so, it's lies, really. But, you know, I've been crying like everybody else has, right? A lot when I saw Obama speak at Grant Park. And now every time I read about somebody else weeping over the election, I sort of weep over the election all over again. And I think I'm weeping because you just feel like, well, partly because there's something just lovable about his face, but it's that you feel like an alien for so long. For so many years, you felt like everything I believe, the country believes the opposite. Right. And I've spent so much of my intellectual energy in the last 8 years thinking, well, I know what I think of this, but what does the rest of the country think of this? And when McCain picked Palin, for example, I thought, well, I know what I think, but how is this going to play? And so you almost became your take on the world. It's not what you thought, but what you thought the country would think. But and it was so gratifying to see that the country rejected Palin. And that's why I cry, I think.
Maybe she'll come back and you can...
Yeah, I might try it before. Again. Oh, that would be wonderful if she ran in 2012. It would be great.
What do you think of her use of the English language as a writer?
Did anybody read...
As a writer.
It is unparalleled. It is unparalleled.
Do you think you could recreate that voice on the page?
I know. I've tried. You know, you try and you just can't. Did anybody read Dick Cavett's piece about her? And I noticed the New York Times is doing this thing. I swear somebody in the editorial room is doing this. You notice that they are not cleaning up her quotes at all?
Yeah.
Somebody in the editorial room is saying, we're going to leave all those quotations, I should say.
I think it's if you have a few grammatical errors, they'll help you out.
Right.
But if it's just a whole style,
exactly.
then you lose the personality.
Yeah, you risk. I love what Cavett said. I've never ever seen a paragraph where you could take away two-thirds of the word fully and not change the meaning nor discern the meaning. Yeah.
I think it's still the most emailed story. You know,
yeah, it is.
The
it's number
emailed.
One for
it's
days
hanging around
and
in the,
days
in the
and
top
days.
Three.
Yeah, that's right. But as I was saying before, I mean, if you were Sarah Palin, and somebody said to you, not if you're Sarah Palin, would you like to be vice president? What would you say? You'd say, well, thanks, I'm flattered, but I'm not up to it.
Yeah.
But I couldn't do it.
You would blink.
Right, you would blink.
Very,
yeah, exactly,
very,
you would blink.
Very
I didn't
least.
Blink. And there's some kind of strange narcissism, and you see it all through different fields. There's, you know, confidence without, you know, often wrong, never in doubt.
It's probably an enviable... stance,
yeah, it must
right?
be a wonderful way to live. It must be a wonderful way to live.
I don't think there are that many writers that have that.
I don't think that's a problem with writers. Well, it might be. It actually is a problem with writers.
You're listening to Ethan Kanen in conversation with Judson True on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco.
Just to go back to the liberal do-gooders, in the book, it's not just Senator Bonwiller who sort of fits that mold of Kennedy or Roosevelt, but probably outside of the narrative, the main character of the book is Liam, and I haven't heard it pronounced, so maybe I'll let you do it. Tell me about the family of the benefactor of the narrator and how he plays into the book.
Yeah, his name is Liam Medderie, I should say. And I came up with it. You never know how you come up with these ideas. I always think I'm making everything up. But does anybody remember David Duke? You do. How do people remember David Duke? Gosh, he was running for governor of Louisiana. Yeah. White supremacist, member of the Ku Klux Klan.
He was the sort of character that you couldn't believe wasn't on the fringe, that he was actually running for office.
Right, and he was right up there in the last couple of days. Yeah. He had a chance at it. And the signs down there said something like, you know, vote for the crook, because they, who was running against him? Was it?
Edwards?
I want to say Edwards, but I...
Edwin Edwards?
Yeah, Edwin Edwards. Yeah, very good. Judson, man, good. And he was the crook, but they said vote for the crook because it was better than
David Duke. Politics is often, but not always, about the lesser of two evils.
Exactly. Right? And I went to one of his rallies in Metairie, Louisiana. It was a white supremacist rally. I was by myself in a state I don't know at all. And it was nighttime, and I went to this white supremacist rally because I was interested in this politics of what gave the guy like this power, what gave a guy like Duke power. So I went to this rally at night, and I was so frightened that the name Metairie just stuck in my head, and that became the name of that guy. But I remember seeing him, and he was such an unimpressive man in person. He was small, slight, not very strong-voiced, but he had a big head. And so he looked great on TV. And when they lit his head, he looked powerful. Actually, there's a line in this about the senator here has a big head, looks lit for TV. Lit for TV, and that was because of that David Duke event.
Although he had the voice as well, the authoritative
voice. Yeah, he does
voice.
Have the authoritative voice, but it was interesting to see that this somewhat ineffectual man in person was dynamic in front of a television camera.
When I first saw
Obama speak in Iowa, I was not impressed with him. I thought he's a young guy, he's too young, he's callow. But he does look different on TV. And that means something. I mean, that, you know, part of the job of the presidency is to inspire the population.
And his speech in Grant Park was incredible, right?
I thought it was very serious,
but it was, I think it was the most impressive thing I've seen in my life.
I also loved his speech on race that he gave in Philadelphia.
Although that, to me, had the feeling of sort of, it was sad that speaking so clearly was so unusual for a politician, or so frankly.
But it was the first time, for example, I'd ever heard anybody talk about Jews and blacks.
Yeah.
You know, which has always been an issue, never talked about. He's the man to step over that divide, you know. He's the guy, it seems to me.
I've also never met the
sort of intelligentsia class who was so wholeheartedly set up for a disappointment here, because everybody is so enthusiastic.
But maybe we have a little bit of pragmatism that we can weave in there too, right?
Yeah, maybe we do.
I thought about All the King's Men some as I read this, and you mentioned Louisiana a minute ago. Did that play into your background at all, writing such a big, sweeping, ambitious political novel?
Yeah. You all know it's a Robert Penn Warren novel that won the Pulitzer Prize. What year? That's an rely on you. Anybody?
It's 45. It's based on Huey Long, early 40s.
Based on Huey Long, who's another. He's sort of an antithesis to the Roosevelt, you know, to Teddy and Franklin and the Kennedys, who were populist but aristocratic.
And he was
not. He was a populist, but he was, he had to pay for his own books and that kind of thing when he went to school. You know, I had never read All the King's Men. Only after everybody could throw a stick at compared to All the King's Men did I have to read it. So I read it. NPR called me and said, they're doing a show on All the King's Men. Could I be the expert on it?
Really?
So I said, okay, I can do it. I had read it. And then it's like an hour before the show, they said, oh, by the way, the other expert is the Robert Penn Warren Professor of Studies at Louisiana State University. But luckily, it was a phone conversation, so I had my computer in front of me. I could Google
Shouldn't
things.
Shouldn't give away your secrets, either.
Yeah, right, those are secrets. But
what did you say to match up to this academic expert?
You know, not much of any good. But, I mean, Penn Warren is a beautiful prose stylist. I actually think that book is a little long. Anybody know that book? For my taste, it could have been cut. But that's...
Fair enough. What about Liam Metairie? Tell us about him. I think he's the most interesting character in America.
Yeah, and he's a character I like the most. He's the son of a magnate, a coal and railroad and rock mining and timber magnate that essentially owns this town in western New York State. And I was interested in also in people like him who come from power and wealth and yet have the public good in mind. I loved him personally as a writer, so it probably comes off. That's probably why you liked him, because if the writer likes him, the reader likes him. You know, how far that generosity will go, that's a question I always have. You know, how far will George Soros let his fortune dwindle in the interest of public good? One of the things I learned, you learn something every couple of years when you're a writer.
That's it.
It's about right. I'd say one thing a year about writing, that is. And what I learned on this book is that it takes a couple of years to unwrite your last book. It took me a couple of years to unwrite the last book, and now I know I'm going to spend a couple of years unwriting this book. And I really loved these characters, and I could write another book with these characters. Random House had me turn it in a year early. If I could have gone through it one more time, I would have loved to have gone through it one more time. They wanted it out before the election, which I realize is a big mistake, because when's the last time you read any fiction?
It was all
538 all the time, basically.
Yeah.
Real clear politics. And maybe people will get back to fiction, but I think people are not that interested.
Did you read less fiction during the election cycle?
All I read was 538.com and Real Clear Politics. I didn't like Real Clear Politics, but Talking Points Memo. And I read the Drudge Report, too. I love reading all that stuff.
What was it like to be in Iowa in January when Obama won?
It was extraordinary. It was more interesting to be there during the primaries. You mean January, when he won the primary?
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. I mean, you really get to vet people person to person. I remember sitting in a room with Edwards, about half the size of this when he was talking. And then I shook his hand afterwards. And I have to say, I almost voted for him because I said, you know, Ethan Cain. And he said, you won Emperor of the Year right off the bat without any prompting. His aides weren't whispering in his ear, I'm sure of that.
And he turned out to have a little of that personal ruthlessness.
He did have it. And I was on a book tour, and I was with my wife, who's there you are, and we were staying at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, and I picked up a National Enquirer, because I read them every day, and it had this story about John Edwards being caught with this woman, Riel, is that her name? Riel Hunter.
It just sort of went by me.
Yeah, that's her name. I just don't know how to pronounce it. And I thought, oh my gosh, I read the story, I thought, well, it seems kind of true. I don't read the Enquirer, so I didn't know I had no reason, way to judge it. I mean, there's quotes in it. You know, they quoted people. I thought, well, that seems true. I mean, the security guard had to, they can't quote the security guard. And so I gave a reading in L.A. that night, and there were a lot of people. There were a couple hundred people. And I said, you know, terrible about John Edwards being caught in Beverly Hilton with that girl, and you know, or that woman, excuse me. And people just looked back stony-faced. Nobody had heard of it. I thought, oh, my gosh, what did I just say?
You outed yourself as a National Enquirer.
I did. And it disappeared. This was an interesting lesson. It disappeared. It did not appear in the mainstream press for 3 full weeks after that, which actually goes back to this book.
Yeah.
And the Edwards campaign was just able to stonewall reporters. They would not answer their questions. And they hoped it would pass over, which is exactly what this senator does in that book. And in a way, the web does not allow that to happen.
Yeah, that was an unusual case, maybe because there wasn't much at stake with him anymore, right, with Edwards? Whereas in this case, I mean, you're writing about an earlier time, and there's a tremendous amount at stake because your character
right.
is the front runner, essentially, for the Democratic nomination.
Right.
Against...
But yeah. I'm trying to remember the day. This was not until July, I would think. So
he wasn't a candidate anymore.
He was...
Oh, when the Enquirer story was out, he was. And then
yeah, he was still...
Died.
Oh, yeah, it hadn't been settled yet. I mean, it was probably mathematically close to settled. Hmm. Can anybody help us out on that, on those times? Yes, Barb. My wife, Barb.
I think the first started following the story in the fall when he was still a candidate, but they didn't have enough information, and he was caught
to do the
Hilton in July.
Right. Thank you.
Got it. Thank you very much. Your better half helped us out.
Exactly. You know, but I mean, and actually with Chappaquiddick, that, you know, there's a website called Why Ted K that I did some research on. And, it, you know, it's pretty damning. It's pretty damning, but it's, and that family's been able to, you know, tamp that down.
The events of this book stretch out over a longer time than Chappaquiddick, though to some extent. Chappaquiddick, he, by the next few days, he was back. He was having to explain.
And he issued an apology on television. And there are only a couple of moments in this book that are based on fact. And one is Ted Kennedy's speech in television was the speech that Henry Bonneman makes is similar to the speech.
Really very bad, right?
What did you say, BAD?
Was it ineffective? It was...
I actually don't know whether it was effective. That was 1969. I was 9 years old. But the striking thing about it is that... I mean, I love what Kennedy has done, but it was a lot of lies in that speech, yeah. I think.
There's some other historical moments that I'd read about in studying political history that you brought to life incredibly well. One would be, and I was telling a friend about it who had never heard of it, the Edmund Muskie crying episode. I'm sure some of the audience here probably know about that. The man from Maine, right? He set that up a little bit, and then maybe I have a section if you have interest in reading that part.
Yeah, I'd love to read that section. I mean, it's interesting to me because as any of you here cognizant in 1972... There we go. You remember Muskie. He was the front runner. And in front of the offices of the union leader in Manchester, New Hampshire, William Loeb, the publisher of that paper, was a, I believe, son of a bitch is the word.
Yeah, I think. I always think of him kind of as a John Bircher, although I know that's not right. Sort of.
Well, he was a conservative Republican, if that's like what that. You mean. And he's, he had, it's some henchmen who had written some falsified letters to various papers saying that Muskie had called French Canadians, Canucks, and this and that. And also they'd gone after Muskie's wife. After Muskie's wife, calling her a drinker and a lot of bad things. And Muskie on national television broke into tears. In fact, I shouldn't say anymore because I'm going to read this section.
I think that's a good setup. And
what's interesting to me, though, well, let me read this section, then we can talk about it. And as far as I know, although my brother will correct me, this is the only thing that comes from an actual event. On the afternoon of February 26th, I know the date because I've read the history, I was in the downstairs atrium putting together position sheets for this. I should say this is told from the point of view of a narrator. His name is Corey Sifter, who's 16 years old for most of the where the book takes place, but he's in his 50s when he narrates it. He works for Senator Henry Bonneweller as he runs for the Democratic nomination in 1972 against Muskie. Who else?
McGovern.
People, I do this a lot. People never remember McGovern. Yeah. Humphrey, George Wallace, who was shot in Maryland and won, I believe, either two or three primaries after he was shot. A few others. And so he's a 50-year-old now, looking back on this time. On the afternoon of February 26, I know the date because I've read the history, I was in the downstairs atrium putting together position sheets for the statewide papers when I heard a whooping shout from the upstairs study. It sounded like Henry Bonneweller. That's the senator, Henry Bonneweller. And a moment later, Mr. Medary. Presently, the door opened and the senator leaned out. He came to the hallway railing next to where the Secret Service man sat reading the paper and looked down. When he saw nobody but me, he said, "Well, shoot, get on up here, boy, right now." "What is it, sir?" "Got some good news. Get up here before you miss it." That morning, I'd taken the bus home from Dunleavy, and Dunleavy is the private high school that this wealthy Medary family sends this young boy to. That morning, I'd taken the bus home from Dunleavy, fearing that this weekend with the campaign was going to be my last. I'd begun to steel myself to finishing out the year, too, using my weekends to get ahead on my classes until it was warm enough for soccer. Henry Bonneweller now trailed Muskie by 13 points. Aberdeen West was at a fraction of its normal capacity, and the bustle of all the reporters, which had given the house a constant air of anticipation, had dwindled to almost nothing. The marble entrance halls echoed. I climbed the stairs and entered the library. There was no one there but Mr. Medary and the senator. On TV, Walter Cronkite was talking about the trial of Angela Davis that was set to begin in California. "Change the station," the senator says. "Got to be on one of them by now." Liam Medary did. First, he turned to ABC, where Harry Reasoner was speaking outside a banquet hall in Peking. No, that's not it. "I know that, Henry," said Mr. Medary. "I'm looking." "It's Muskie," the senator went on, turning to me. It might have been the first time he'd ever addressed me outside the car rather than to give an order. "We just got a call. Some dinky newspaper ran a piece about his wife. Says she smokes and drinks." "It was the union leader," said Mr. Medary from the TV. He changed the channel again. "The Manchester union leader. They say Jane Muskie smokes and drinks and tells dirty jokes. Ha, ha, ha." He bumped me on the shoulder with a scotch glass, then took a drink. "Well," he bellowed, "who doesn't? And now look at what the guy does." He turned to Lee Medary. "You found it yet?" "Still looking, Henry." On the screen now, a commercial was ending. Then David Brinkley came on. This was NBC. "Jesus Christ, almighty God," said Henry Bonneweller, and he pulled me by the arm until I was right next to him in front of the TV. "Watch this, boy." The picture is muffled by snow, not by static, but by real snow, which is falling heavily in Manchester that day. Edmund Muskie is standing on the bed of a truck in front of the union leader offices, where as the snow swirls around him, he proceeds to defend the honor of his wife against William Loeb, the paper's publisher. "He's talking about the drinking and the dirty jokes," Henry Bonneweller said, bumping my arm again with the glass. "That Loeb's a son of a bitch, all right, worse than the rat who feed him. But if I know Jane Muskie, he'd better talk faster. Shh," said Liam Medary. "Here it comes." Then, in the middle of it, as David Brinkley begins to narrate, Senator Muskie suddenly appears to break down. In the thickening snowfall, the picture is hard to discern. The camera moves in closer. He's recovered now and is shaking his fist in the air, but then it happens a second time. He convulses for a moment, and at this point, there's no doubt. He's crying on national television. "Come on," Henry Bonneweller nearly shouted. "Did you see that? Did you see that?" "Yes, sir," I said. "He does it again, boy. Keep watching." And he does, 1 week before the primary. "Get the scotch, Liam, the good stuff." "It does look promising for us, Henry," said Mr. Medary. He turned to me. "Promising? That horse been rode hard and put to bed wet. That's the end of him, son, right there." He ran his finger across his throat. "Period. End of poem." He rose and slapped Mr. Medary on the back. "Let's have a drink to this fine day of hunting. Give the boy a drink, Liam." He pulled a bottle of Glenlivet from the cabinet and poured a glass. "Here," he said, "do not go gentle into that good night." I don't think Corey's ever tasted scotch. "Nonsense," said Henry Bonneweller. "It's all I drank at his age." "To President Bonneweller, then," said Liam Medary. "To President Bonneweller," I repeated, holding up my drink. "Oh, I like that," he roared. He raised his own tumbler of scotch to the ceiling, then followed it with his eyes like a man having a vision. "To President Bonneweller," he said softly. Then he lowered his arm, and at that moment, as though instead of a glass in his hand, he'd been holding a wand, phones began ringing all over the house. The interesting thing of that, of course, this year, Senator Clinton's campaign was revitalized by crying in New Hampshire.
Yep.
A campaign that was on the ropes was revitalized. So I don't know if that's, I mean, obviously she's a woman, he was a man, but there is a sea change in the society that we want. I think Bill Clinton was the ship that brought that change in. You know, wanted a therapized president at that point.
I think our mayor is on Dr. Phil tomorrow. So
that's all right. Right.
So especially because you have some students here, I wanted to ask you how teaching writing at Iowa, having been a student there, how that affects your writing, how that's going. Are you having a great time still teaching at Iowa?
I have to say, my students are great. I have the greatest students. I don't know. I love teaching. And there are times when I honestly think, and I see a couple of you out there, I think, what am I doing? Because to be a writer, you have to be smart, smarter than average. And meanwhile, they're dumber than average. Friends have gone to business school, law school, medical school, and my students who are terrific. You know, so they takes them a couple of years. They publish a book. Then maybe they're 28 when they get there. They're 31 when they leave. They have one book. Second book is kind of what makes you as a writer. 35, and then what do they do? You know, they're 35, no prospects of making a living. They're teaching at Wichita State, and I sometimes. I wonder whether... That's what bothers me. I worry about that. But teaching is wonderful. And you really... When I was a doctor, I felt that, you know, about 60% of my day was adversarial. I was only a medical resident, so maybe that was... But as a teacher, I feel like almost none of it is adversarial. It's a lovely, lovely thing. I mean, you get this intimate contact with people, and especially with teaching writing, you know, people are... It's not like I'm teaching accounting or something. They're really... It's lovely.
Well,
I can't complain.
Personal engagement in the work.
Yeah, and you really. I mean, liking a writer essentially is falling in love with that intelligence. And I read so many good stories. I read 20 times a year. I read something I couldn't have written myself, written by my students. It's great.
One of your, I think, former students is a friend of a friend, and I was emailing asking for anecdotes, and I heard that you're not that good a skateboarder.
No, that's not true. I'm a very good skateboarder.
Brett Johnston.
This is one of my former students who was a professional skateboarder, I should say.
He said he tried to teach you and you should stick to
riding. Yeah, well, I had gotten older. Some of the fear had come back. No, I used to be a good skateboarder.
He helped you build a tremendous treehouse.
That's right. He's now head of creative writing at Harvard. So it's nice to be teaching kids who do that well. It's a lovely thing.
So you said, I think that when you wrote your first book of stories, you wrote them in part at medical school because you were supposed to be doing something else, whereas you hadn't written as much when you were at Iowa. So you've done the science-literature switch, been obviously with literature for a while with writing. What's next? You said in a few interviews you're ready for another change, and it's not skateboarding. I do feel that.
I've had enough of writing. I just signed a contract for 2 books, though, so that's the end of that. That's the end of that wish. I don't know. You know, there's a certain... writing is so... You know, it's very, very difficult. The thing with medicine is hard, but once you know it, you kind of can do it. You don't wake up, right, every morning and think, can I do it today? Where you do with writing, and it's very, very hard. And, you know, the thing with like a book like a novel, you're 4 years into it before you know whether it's even going to make sense, whether you've convinced anybody of it. There's always a dark night of the soul when you realize that your book makes no sense about two-thirds of the way through it. You know, I thought of fixing up houses. You know, I love doing that. I think it's probably not the time to buy up houses and to try to flip them. I'm getting that feeling.
You could add value. There's always a market if you add value.
Yeah, I guess there's a little market there. But, you know, I do miss feeling I did something helpful or practical. Helpful might be too self-flattering, but practical.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Tonight's program features Ethan Kanan.
You grew up in a musical family. I mean, you must have heard music every day in your house.
Yeah.
His father played the violin.
Yeah.
Do you play any instruments, or how has music affected you?
Are you a musician?
No, I'm a doctor.
A doctor. I did grow up in a musical family. I mean, there was never silence in our house. And, you know, I hear language. I hear the rhythm of language. I cannot read rhythm in music to save my life. Isn't that right, Dad? Where's my dad? Can you verify that? I cannot read rhythm. My 12-year-old daughter reads rhythm perfectly. I'm very mathematical, and I cannot read rhythm. And I have the secret suspicion that it's because actually I feel rhythm so intensely that I can't, you know, read it on the page. But I always hear writing comes to me as syllables. I know a number of writers. I feel like the words don't even matter. It's what the syllables and the emphasis is. John Cheever was one of my first influences as a writer, a great writer who's almost unknown now among younger people. No, not among old Jews, but among younger people. almost unknown. And he had such an extraordinary sense of rhythm. It was musical. And he took regular words. I mean, Saul Bellow, another great writer of language. But Bellow, if you took the words out of a Bellow paragraph and shook them out, threw them on the floor, they'd be interesting words. If you took the words of a Cheever paragraph, they're just regular words. They're not interesting words. But he took those rhythms and he made them into something extraordinary. It's kind of like Kabuki theater, you know, just with a mask. No props, no nothing. He just did it with rhythm. And that's how I write. It's always by rhythm. It's clicks. I feel music very strongly, but I just can't sing or I play a little bit. But I, you know, I crave silence. I grew up with so much music. I don't listen to music at all. Here's my student, Katie. Yes.
Hi. Given that the suffering to write is immense, could you just talk about a moment of deep pleasure you had when you were writing this book and how that came about?
I had very few, to be honest, and I hate to tell you that. Occasionally I would read it at night, late at night, after my wife had gone to sleep, I'd read it in my bed, and occasionally I think, wow, it's pretty good. Sometimes, just like 3 or 4 pages. But other than that, it's mostly agony. I wish I could tell you. My wife hasn't had a moment of pleasure yet. What was it? Well, I guess so. That was a pleasure. I make a big storyboard. I make a big story out of extruded polystyrene foam, you know, the rigid foam insulation, the pink insulation, and my big storyboard. And it was actually great. My wife and I spent 6 weeks before it was due going through it and made a big storyboard, and that was fun. But that's not writing. That's just like hanging out with your wife. Writing, I hate to tell you this, Katie. I didn't tell you this until you graduated, but it is almost all agony. Now, it is like running, though. It's very much like running. There are some moments when running is essentially pain, right? Anybody here who runs is pain. But then, essentially, occasionally there's that runner's high when you feel that moment. And there is, to be honest, yeah, sometimes. There's a moment when it kind of goes a little bit.
You don't like to...
You feel good. No, I feel good that I've written, but that's different. That's different. I write first thing in the morning because otherwise it ruins my day. This way it only ruins my morning.
And you don't like to edit or you,
well, editing,
you
don't, I don't understand editing. How do you edit? No, I edited this book tremendously. I wrote this book like 8 or 9 times. How do you edit, though? To make something up, you have to be manic. You have to be crazy. You have to be a little crazy. It's almost physical. I remember being there and seeing these manics, these full-blown manics who would come in, and I was nothing but envious at their unbelievable inventive power. No, I kid you not. It's genius. It is genius. What a full-blown psychotic person can come up with. And schizophrenics have, you know, like clanging, and they make up words, you know, they're poetic. I mean, and they don't make up words like sales associate. They don't make up words like that. They make up words that you'll remember the rest of your life, because there is something about craziness that is keyed into the centers of meaning in your brain. And the trick as a writer, you're trying to get there as you're writing. You're trying to be a little crazy and come up with these things that are imagistic and profoundly powerful without you knowing why. That's the whole point of writing fiction, is that you don't know why things mean something, but they do. And then to edit, you have to be cold, you have to be calculated, you have to be sort of the opposite of Sarah Palin. You have to be, you know, self-critical. You have to judge. You have to be self-critical. And yet at the same time, you have to still invent. I just think it just can't be done. I don't know how it's done. I don't know how anybody rewrites. And at the same time, you're thinking, am I taking out the only good paragraph in this whole book? You just don't know. And I've watched movies being edited now, and it's the same thing. You shoot a bucket load of footage, and you know the director sits there, and then he gets this footage, he looks at it, and you know, you can make any one of 200, 500 movies from that same footage. And what you do at that point is what makes or breaks the thing. And you just don't know what you're doing.
I devoured America, America, and thanks. I really came away with only one sense of shortcoming. And this is out of pure ignorance, because I'm a doctor. But I don't know anything about Western New York, but I sense that these people should have been going to church, and Christianity should have played some role in this book, and I missed it.
Ah, you know what? You're right. Absolutely. I would have gone through this book. I mean, if I had gone through this book one more time, I wanted to add the 70s into the book, because the 70s are not that prevalent in the book. That was my last draft. I was going to go through and make it really take place in the 70s, and they said, nope. Got to have it out in May before the convention. So I turned it in. And you're absolutely right. Christianity would have been a big part of it. It's hard for me to imagine religiosity. I'm a neurological atheist. I can't get beyond that. But you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It should have played a part in it.
You're talking about the writing process. When you're writing, do you hear voices from your characters, and do they inhabit a certain space in your head? Can you talk about some more about what you do to get into your writing space? And then you also mentioned, you know, editing. And how do you carry on that binary conversation with yourself, where you have to be right-brained and left-brained at the same time?
Yeah, you obviously write fiction.
Yes.
Do you hear those? As we used to say, do you ever hear voices that other people don't hear?
I'd like to think I do.
There's another similarity.
I would say that, I mean, some people, like, you know, I won't name any names, but writing seems to them, you know, this gift from God, and, you know, they're just like writing down what their characters are telling them to write down. I think that's a little much, personally. Writing is agony. To write anything, 700 pages of anything is hard. Danielle Steele used to teach at University High School. She was my English teacher as a freshman in high school, and she had written one book. And people laugh at Danielle Steele. But, you know, she writes a book a year, more than a book a year. And that is extraordinarily impressive. I don't care what it is that she can do that. And the characters have the same names all the way through. And there's a plot. That's tough. So I would say, yes, I try to approach that crazy feeling. And I actually sit there physically. It's like a physical jump you try to make in which you become somebody else. Today I was walking in Chinatown looking at every face I passed, and this is an exercise describing it, coming up with just something to describe it. And it's actually interesting, and you'd be amazed at how quickly you just get really good at it, and these things like jump to mind. And there is a lot to language that, I mean, a native speaker of a language senses so much in every word. It's incredible. You know, watch the difference between, you know, a certain phrasing and another phrasing. So I try to get myself sort of riled up. With a couple of friends, I started the San Francisco Writers Quarto about 15 years ago. And Poe, one of them, Poe Bronson, is one of the guys I started with. And he, writes in a closet that's almost no bigger than his knees. It's like the United Airlines Memorial Closet. And it's, you know, it's like this, and it's dark. And, you know, that's what it takes him. I find that music helps. I listen to Berlioz's Romeo and Juliet. You know, not the whole thing, but just about four bars of it, over and over and over again when I was writing one of the books. There's just something, how can you explain that? It was some, like, chord change that just made me want to write. It's inexplicable. But it's definitely aural in the sense that you hear something. You hear the rhythm. The one thing I find incurable in my students is certain students want to control everything. They want to set out to write a story that shows that love is, in fact, the mirror of death. And you just can't do that. It just doesn't work that way.
Could you talk about the influence of geography on your writing, and specifically living in Iowa City and then going to northern Michigan, and what that's like, and has northern Michigan influenced you in any way?
Are you from where? What's your geographical history?
Chicago.
I have to say, even before Obama was elected, it is my favorite city. It is an incredible city. If you go to Chicago, most of you must know Chicago. It's a wonderful city. I'd say one thing about geography. I mean, one of the things you learn, it takes about four things to be a writer. The first is a prose style. Either you have it or you don't. The second is an interest in people. Either you have it or you don't. The third is the ability to get up after you've been knocked down. I always keep saying the ability to get knocked up. That's not right. The ability to get up after you've been knocked down, that's the third thing. And the fourth thing is the ability to constantly nurture your sense of invention. And so that's something I think a lot about. And one of the things I found is constantly makes me inventive is opening an atlas and looking at a country with a complicated coastline. You know, you look at those inlets and you just think of story. I don't, you know, why is that? I don't know. So having an atlas physically in front of you is one of the things that gives me ideas. Now on the web, for example, you can look up, like I wrote my last novel, Carry Me Across the Water, about a guy who was a soldier in the Second World War. You can look up the ship diary of every ship in the Second World War. You know, they have the daily travails. You know, we saw a kamikaze today or shot two down off the starboard, you know, blah, 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 blah. Almost every ship had a naval historian. You can look at letters home. So nonfiction is a big source of ideas for me. Now, geography itself, I moved around so much as a kid that I have no sense of home. I don't have my Pawtucket County. I don't have anything like that. I moved to San Francisco when I was about 9 or 10, but I felt I'd been formed in smaller towns in the Midwest. And, you know, I'm Jewish, but actually San Francisco feels more of a Jewish town than it did then. It wasn't a very Jewish town then. I certainly didn't feel it. Until the first time I went to New York when I was maybe 23, I remember getting out of a cab from LaGuardia and thinking, oh, my God, I come home. You know, I'd never realized that I'd felt sort of like an outsider all my life. So I'd never had that sense of geography. So like some of my books, like this is like a, you know, you mentioned Christianity. This is like a Gentile, wealthy, Western New York State family. You know, my last book was like a... Yeah, with a compound. And my last book was like, you know, like a hard-bitten Jew. You know,
in Pittsburgh.
I don't have it. Yeah, in Pittsburgh.
I just went to Pittsburgh for the first time, and right. I thought about Carry Me Across the Water
right.
again.
And I've never been to Pittsburgh.
But it's a big part of the book.
Yeah, I've never been to Pittsburgh. John Updike reviewed this book. He said, blah, 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 blah. And he looks at New York State with the eye of a native, which I was very happy with. But I'd never been to Western New York State. Never in my life have I been there. So, you know, I don't have that sense of geography. In a sense, that's freeing. I can do whatever I want. But
so how'd you write about Pittsburgh without having...
It just seemed fictional to me. It had three rivers intersecting. You know, it was where people went to do big things. You know, they went to smelt steel. Yeah. You know, it was an incredible thing.
One of my good friends is here, and he grew up in Squirrel Hill, which is where your character is. So it's seemed like it evoked it very well.
Yeah, well, thanks. I've never been there.
All right, I think...
Well, one last question.
One last question.
I was wondering, do you think you were born with that ear for the sound of words, or did it develop over time, you know, just from reading a lot, or how, you know, did you always know?
Do you write?
No, but my daughter does, and so I wonder.
Does she have an ear?
Yes. She falls asleep, you know, to the sound of certain words, you know, lull her to sleep, and so... You know, she's pretty young still, but I just wondered if it's something you can develop over time.
Well, there are things. I don't know. I don't think you do. There's some exercises I can sometimes. If a student comes up to me and says, I just can't hear a rhythm, and some students can't, I'll say, there are certain things you can do. Like you can say a sentence has three parts. It has like the subject part, and it has the middle part, and it has the end part, often known as the predicate, or, you know, or the verb might be the middle. And you could say, I'll hear something, you could say you can load up, generally you can load up two slots of those three, but you can't load up all three. And if you can't, if you have no sense of rhythm, just look down the page and say, are you loading up too many, you know, are all your sentences loaded up on all three slots? You know, you can just look down, there are ways to get around it, but, you know, God forbid you spend your career, you know, in something you were so ill-suited for that you have to... that you have to do that, but it can help you. And there's this feeling you have when you're reading a book with these long sentences, blah, 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 and then you come to a sentence like, and so it was. Or, you know, there's a great story called A Silver Dish by Saul Bellow. Anybody know that story? Great moving story, yay. And it ends with a line, that was the way he was. And you read that line and you just weep. But it's, you know, what's in that sentence? That? It's almost, nobody even knows what that means. And that is sort of, was, another one. What does that mean? The doesn't mean anything. Way doesn't mean a thing. He, maybe a little bit of meaning. Was, again, no meaning at all in those words. It's not like saying apple, tree, branch, those things you can picture. But because of what's come before, that meaningless sentence becomes this incredibly powerful thing. So that's sort of the second transformative power of language, that it's transformed by what has come before, by what you bring to it. So, but in answer to your question, you know, as well as I do, since you have children, that it's 0% nurture. It's all nature. Right?
And with that, we really would like to thank Ethan Kanen and Judson True.
Judson. You're great.
B
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW 91.7 FM. For more information about programs at the Jewish Community Center, you can visit jccsf.org. Tonight's guest is Ethan Kanan in conversation with Judson True. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Michael Geese Graphics, Brandon Battaglia, Devin Krushank, and David Kwan. David Kwan also edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Monday evening at 8 p.m. when Bina will feature the radical Jack London with Jonah Raskin. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.